This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Governor Baker announced today new COVID-19 restrictions, which will go into effect at 12:01 a.m. on December 26th, right after Christmas. They include reducing capacity limits in businesses and houses of worship to 25% and limiting private gatherings and events to 25 people outside, 10 people inside. Here is the governor speaking at a press conference just a little bit ago.
Together, the intent of these restrictions will be to pause activity and reduce mobility so we can reduce the spread of the virus without closing our schools or our businesses.
With these new restrictions and a flurry of activity around the police reform bill going on in the background, we thought who better to turn to than WBUR's Steve Brown. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So I know you're back on daily Baker watch with the surge right now. Yesterday, he said the administration was reviewing additional steps it can take to minimize the impact of this surge. Today, we learned that means lowering capacity limits, reducing the number of people gathering indoors and outdoors. What's the calculation going on here? How much is this quelling the spread in public places? How much is this focused on quelling it among groups of people in private?
Well, I sense they figure that every little bit helps without going so far as to shut everything down. The governor keeps saying he refers to the data and he thinks that the data supports this. He said this is part of what we must do during this critical period when the vaccine is just a few months away to slow the spread, adding, if we can all agree to do the things that slow the spread over the next 2 weeks, it will help us work on building the bridge that we all need to build to get to the vaccine.
So it can't be lost on anyone that these restrictions go into effect at 12:01 a.m. on December 26th. The governor's been talking about the holidays, but this means people could still theoretically gather in large groups for Christmas. They're going to go out and finish that last-minute Christmas shopping. Some will be attending religious services in light of the holiday. So did he address how are these restrictions supposed to make a difference in the holiday concern?
I think in part it's there to stress the urgency. He really wants people to just stick with a handful of people living in their own households, not to go outside the pod, if you will. He says if you must, make sure you follow all the proper protocols, wear a mask, stay socially distanced, all the things that we've been asked to do for months now, but have to really be hyper-vigilant about those things as we go through the holidays.
So over the last couple of weeks, Steve, it does seem like kind of an inch-by-inch approach, incremental. Are you surprised there weren't stricter restrictions announced today, especially things like restaurants, indoor dining?
No, but that is still an option in the governor's toolbox, that's for sure. I think a lot depends on whether there's another spike after the holiday. He may pull those out. Still, he's walking a fine line here, seemingly not wanting to inflict further economic damage on businesses. As a matter of fact, Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito said that people should be ordering takeout from local restaurants and gift cards from local retailers to keep the economy going, but still to be able to do that in a relatively safe manner.
To that point, the governor has stressed he knows this is going to take a toll on small businesses. Should we expect something else from the administration to address that concern?
Absolutely. Tune in tomorrow. That's going to be the focus of tomorrow's briefing. The governor indicated that they will unveil a significant economic relief fund for the small businesses that will be most negatively affected by the restrictions and everything that's happened this year.
All right, Steve, I'd like to shift gears. I know you happen to be at the State House where there are deliberations on the budget going on in the background. We've been covering a lot, and we've talked with you about what the legislature is doing on police reform. Tell us where things stand right now with the police reform bill.
Yeah, I anticipate that a bill that is palatable to the governor will be on his desk by late tonight. It seems that the Senate, the House, and the governor have all reached a compromise in principle, and barring any surprises, it will be passed into law.
So I know that it had originally gone to the governor and he had some objections, sent back some amendments. What has been his opposition to the bill as it was originally submitted to him?
Sure, there are a couple of things. Where the Municipal Police Training Committee was placed, that's the board that oversees police training here in Massachusetts. Now, currently, that is controlled by law enforcement under the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, which is a cabinet secretariat under the Baker administration. The bill the governor returned would have put that under the control of the newly created Civilian Heavy Police Officer Standards and Training Commission, or POST Commission. Also, the governor didn't like the language severely limiting the use of facial recognition technology that was in that bill that was first sent to him.
So tell us about what changes have been made. How is the legislature reacting to what the governor wanted?
Yeah, they changed it so that the Municipal Police Training Committee will stay where it is under EOPS, and police will remain in charge of that. The Post Commission will have some input into police training, but they won't control it. Also, they softened the language on facial recognition. Law enforcement can still obtain it, but they must submit a written request to the RMV, the state police, or the FBI in order to get access to facial recognition.
So you said at the top, you know, you're anticipating a successful compromise. We do know that after the bill went to the governor, there are legislators saying, hey, we cannot afford to compromise further. So what are you hearing now with where this is going to end up?
They're accepting the proposed changes. Some are, of course, disappointed that it doesn't go far enough for their liking, and others feel that it may go too far in limiting what police do. While not happy with the entire compromise, Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz, who's a supporter, says it's a good start.
This bill will establish the most genuinely powerful civilian-controlled police oversight and certification board in the nation. This will set a new standard that has the potential to ripple through the other 49 states.
So, Steve, I want to play another voice for you, too. We spoke with Imari Paris Jeffries, who's the executive director of King Boston. He's a prominent voice on police reform in Boston and in the Commonwealth. He stressed that this first iteration of the police reform bill is just the beginning. Here he is.
This is the first version. And so I think as we get more sophisticated in what it means to disrupt racism, there's no way that we can't revisit this. Even if we got everything that we asked for, we have to model what it means to be in a learning society.
Is that what you're hearing? Do you hear a legislature that thinks we're going to learn over time? And what do you think they'll do with that learning, if so?
Yeah, they're learning that it's a very heavy lift to do what they're trying to do right now. There was some talk last night when I was watching the Senate debate this, a question of, you know, will we really ever get back to this? Or are we going to say, okay, we've done police reform in 2020. We don't have to get to it again for another couple of years. And that's the big question that's out there. Will they really go back and do the other things that people feel are unfinished business from this particular bill? That remains to be seen.
And again, to remind our listeners, you've got the legislature there in the background. Steve, you're at the State House. There is so much more going on. The last question before we let you go. Rumors that there will be a vote on a new House Speaker to replace Robert DeLeo. Do we know when that's going to happen?
We don't know exactly, but I'm sensing it's coming a lot closer. What you're hearing in the background, the House is going through gubernatorial vetoes in the FY21 budget. And at the beginning of everyone, the clerk announces the roll call and says, Mr. DeLeo of Winthrop is voting present. So he's voting present on all of these overrides, which kind of indicates that, he doesn't want to have a conflict of interest because some of this that's being voted on right now may affect his new employer.
Steve, I know I'm a geek, but I just think it's so cool to be able to hear that happening in the background while we talk to you. That's WBUR's Steve Brown. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tiziana.
So let's move to some other Beacon Hill news, because Massachusetts is joining Rhode Island, Connecticut, Washington, D.C. to cut greenhouse emissions from cars and trucks, get this, by nearly 30% by 2032. The three states and D.C. have formed the Transportation and Climate Initiative Program, or TCIP. To get that done, here is Governor Baker announcing the new program yesterday.
This is clearly an important agreement, and it will ultimately strengthen our economy, improve our public health, and allow us to build the resilient, clean transportation system of the future that we all believe we need.
Now, while participants express optimism over what the partnership can accomplish, they are the only four signatories out of 13 original parties in negotiation about a partnership. Here to discuss it all is Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Kathleen Theoharides, who is a key architect of the agreement. Secretary Theoharides, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, this is complicated. I did a lot of reading on it today and even ran it by someone else to make sure I was understanding it. But maybe you can give us kind of the elevator pitch. I know this is emission reductions that would kick in 2032. I understand there's some combination of vehicle emission standards and what's called cap and trade. So how's this going to work?
Yeah, well, first I'll start with a big picture. Across the nation and here in Massachusetts, we're already seeing extreme impacts from climate change, whether it's the increasing severe storms we've seen, more frequent droughts like we had this summer, and extreme heat days that are really harmful for the elderly and vulnerable populations. And these impacts all come with a growing cost. Up to $44 billion a year at the national level is estimated just for some of these storms and climate-related disasters. And so we know that work on climate change and work on air pollution that causes severe public health impacts can't wait. And this type of bold and urgent action to combat climate change is needed. Earlier this year, Governor Baker committed to a net zero by 2050 target, one of just four states now to be doing that. And transportation is 40% of our global warming pollution emissions. So getting emissions down in this sector is critical. What we announced yesterday, Governor Baker joining Governor Ned Lamont, Governor Gina Raimondo, and Mayor Bowser down in D.C., is signing a memorandum of understanding that would commit these jurisdictions to a cap and invest program to cut pollution from transportation emissions by 26% while generating $1.4 billion in Massachusetts by 2032 to invest in a cleaner, more equitable transportation system.
So I'm just going to break in there so that we understand it for listeners. What essentially that then means is a core component is that fuel distributors, they pay per ton of emissions. And then in order to have the right to produce those emissions, that's how you control the price of that and the amount of those emissions that are allowed. And that's how we then control and make the change. But at the same time, that also means that there's increased costs and some of those costs go on to consumers. So one, is that correct? And two, what's that going to mean for fuel prices like gas prices here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, so the program, as you said, will require large gasoline and diesel fuel suppliers to purchase allowances to cover the carbon content or the pollution that's in the fuels they sell into a region. And this is very similar to how the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative charges allowances for electricity generators. But in this case, fuel suppliers operate in these competitive marketplaces, and as there's a growing diversity of fuels, the price signal will actually spur them to clean up the carbon content of the fuels and innovate to reduce that content so they can purchase less credits. If they choose to pass on some of the cost of those credits, that cost is estimated to be right around 5 cents on a gallon of gas and no higher than 9 cents, because the program has cost protection built in to protect consumers from any higher prices.
So I know that the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts has said, understanding that 9 cents cap is in place, that could put getting to the emission goal at risk, because their study finds that the price at the pump would have to go up more like 13, maybe even 24 cents a gallon to meet these targets. How do you control the costs, meet the targets, and thread that needle?
So there were a lot of differences between the Tufts study and the work we have done, and not the least of which was that the Tufts study did not assume that the states would be making investments to reduce emissions with the money that is being returned to the state. And that's a key part of the strategy. In addition to the cap reducing the number of allowances every year and therefore cutting carbon, the money that comes back to the states gets reinvested in things like electric vehicles, better public transit, high-speed wireless that allows more people to work at home, and other things that clean up our transportation sector and give people better options. And that's a significant source of the emission reductions we're going to see from the program.
So, you know, I know that New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu pulled out earlier in the process, pulled New Hampshire out due to concerns about gas prices. I do want to stay on this a minute longer. Mm-hmm. The Conservative Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance has essentially argued that this is going to feel like a tax increase to people during a really tough time. How are you addressing those concerns? And, you know, what's the long-term payoff that you're telling people who have that criticism is going to make it worth it to bear these increases in costs during a challenging economic time?
Well, I'd say a number of things on this front. First and foremost, we delayed the program so that it would be happening later and so that any cost that might be passed on won't occur until 2023. So there is significant time before some of these costs occur. But more importantly, the revenue will be a game changer for job creation, for better transit that helps people get to and from work, to and from medical appointments. And it can also be invested in ways to specifically help lower-income drivers here in the Commonwealth. Low-income rebates are something that is on the table for consideration. And very importantly, at least 35% of the proceeds are set aside for environmental justice and underserved communities in the Commonwealth. And that's a minimum. States can go above and beyond that to provide more money, particularly to those communities that have been hard hit by environmental pollution issues, but also by COVID-19.
All right, so last question for you. Originally, there were 13 parties having conversations about this, 4 signatories now. Do you need more players involved for it to be effective? And if so, what's the strategy for bringing other states into the fold?
Well, this is a historic and first in the nation agreement. And so we always have expected that not every state would be ready at the same time to go forward on this, much like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that picked up states as they went forward. We expect to pick up states as we go forward with this. We don't need other states to get the same pollution benefits and investment benefits here in Massachusetts and Rhode Island and Connecticut. We get those benefits no matter how many states play. But just as we've done on our other climate strategies, whether it's offshore wind or regional electric markets or resiliency, we think that it's always great to be able to influence what other states are doing so that we can reduce emissions on a more global scale. And as more states join the initiative, which we very much expect them to do, we will be continuing to ramp up those emission reduction targets. But I should be very clear here. This region is 73% of New England's emissions. It's a big portion of GDP in the region, and we all have our own in-state targets to hit. This program will help us do just that.
Okay. And that is Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Kathleen Theoharides. Thanks for giving us the time today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, as 2020 comes to a close, we are doing a number of year-in-review conversations. Yesterday, we did the year in social media, for example. Well, we had originally thought we'd do a year in medicine, too, but it didn't take us long to realize that the year in medicine has really been about one thing.
I am issuing the following emergency order. Effective Tuesday, March 24th, all non-essential businesses shall close their physical workplaces and facilities.
The CDC is advising the use of non-medical cloth face covering as an additional voluntary public health measure. So it's voluntary. You don't have to do it. They suggest it for a period of time. But this is voluntary. I don't think I'm going to be doing it.
This is going to be basically a way of life, okay? There's no ifs, no ands, no buts, no doubts, okay? You're going to be expected to wear a face covering or a mask.
Supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it.
I stand here as someone who has had confirmed orders for millions of pieces of gear evaporate in front of us. And I can't tell you how frustrating it is.
I came here, wasn't feeling so well. I feel much better now. We're working hard to get me all the way back. I have to be back.
As a vaccine, it's more than 90% effective, which is extraordinary and will play a major role in what the outcome of this is going to be.
On the first day I'm inaugurated to say I'm going to ask the public for 100 days to mask. Just 100 days to mask. Not forever, 100 days.
This is not just the worst public health event. This is the worst event that this country will face, not just from a public health side.
So there you heard Governor Charlie Baker, President Trump, Anthony Fauci, Joe Biden, Deborah Birx. And now news just today that Governor Baker is again restricting capacity on indoor and outdoor gatherings. You know, the year's pandemic events are almost too much to take in. You hear all of that sound. How much has changed? But we're going to try, and we want to take your calls. We want you to do it with us. What did you learn about medicine and healthcare in this year of the pandemic? What do you think we're going to face in 2021? You know, are you ending the year heartbroken, hopeful, both? And what outstanding coronavirus questions do you have? We have two doctors here with us today. They can help answer them. So our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I said, we've got a great team of folks to help us make sense of all this year. First up is WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Hey there, Carrie.
Hey there, Tiziana.
Also with us, Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, Infectious Disease Physician and the Associate Hospital Epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center, also an Assistant Professor of Medicine at Boston University at the School of Medicine. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. You know, we've all been on this journey on air together so many times this year. I have the same opening question for all three of you. I'm going to turn it to Carrie first. Carrie, as a veteran journalist and healthcare reporter, with 2020 gratefully almost in the rearview mirror, how would you write the headline for the pandemic?
Well, I guess if I were putting together the front page of 2020, it would just be the word pandemic in great big block letters, like in 36 point typeface about the size of like the Men Walk on Moon headline from 1969, or even bigger because the moon is, you know, a couple hundred thousand miles away, while this pandemic affected all of us so directly. And then more on an emotional level, you can't put this in a headline, but for me, this year has been bookended by these two feelings of, oh my God. Like first in the early spring, it was, oh my God, we are going down. This is the big one that the infectious disease Cassandras have been warning about for years. And now it's really happening. And then just in the last couple, 3 months, it's been sort of the good kind of disbelief, as in, oh my God, I can't believe these vaccines are actually this safe and effective. Because I must say, Tiziana, if there's one thing that reporting on health and science for nearly 20 years has taught me, it's that biology is a bear, let's say a bear, and she will break your heart almost every time. And I honestly never expected the vaccine outcomes to be this good this fast. And so in short, it's just been an oh my God year all around.
That is a fantastic summary. It really resonates with me. So let me turn to Drs. Pierre and Boucher. I'm going to ask you the same question. You know, Carrie just gave you her OMGs. Dr. Pierre, what's your headline?
I don't want to be too flippant, and this certainly hasn't necessarily been an even year, but I would say my headline would be, put your trust in science. This has been a year we haven't known who to trust, where to get our information from. We've seen misinformation targeted towards those of us or communities that are most vulnerable and most in need of accurate information. And the truth has been exploited and undermined in so many countless ways. But science has, for the most part, come through for us. It's just figuring out where to get that information from. So that would be my headline. And I share Carrie's amazement in the fact that these vaccines are here and that they performed so well. I was giddy when I read the New England Journal of Medicine article detailing the results of the Pfizer trial. I promised my patients that I would look at all of the data, make sure that everything that I saw or recommended came from a fact-based, science-based perspective, and I felt relieved that I could endorse the vaccine wholeheartedly, the vaccines, I should say, wholeheartedly. So science, above all other things, has come through this year, and it's just figuring out where to get the truth from. That's been the trouble.
Dr. Boucher, let me just put the number out. 800-423-8255 as our listeners start queuing up both your comments and your questions on the coronavirus as we review the year and the pandemic. How about you, Dr. Boucher? We've heard two different headlines here. What would yours be?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with Carrie and Cassandra. And I think what I would add to that is a note about preparedness. You know, we in infectious diseases have been working on being prepared for an event like this for many years, but clearly we as a country were not prepared, whether it be for the space, the stuff, the PPE, the people, the workforce, and that has cost us dearly. I think the other area for which we were not adequately prepared was in communication. And while the source of truth was a question, I think we all could have done better. We in the medical community could have done better in communication. And I think that I'm hopeful about the vaccine, and I'm hopeful that we're speaking with a more united and clear voice about what we all need to do now to get through these next 8 to 12, what are likely to be dark weeks.
Carrie, before I go to the phones, you know, I enjoy these years in review. I enjoy talking to the guests. I enjoy coming up with the themes, but I also know that we have to take a minute right up front here to count the toll as well. People have lost loved ones, friends. Can you put it in perspective? How deep has the toll been here in the Commonwealth and for the nation?
Yeah, I mean, sticking to the Commonwealth, it's just been excruciating. And I want to keep this short because I know we've been putting out a kind of a very demoralizing daily drumbeat of these numbers. But at this point, where we're at is nearly 12,000 Massachusetts residents have died of COVID-19. About two-thirds of them were in nursing homes and other long-term care. We've currently got nearly 2,000 people in the hospital with COVID. And I feel like in the media, we haven't even been able to begin to do justice to the loss and the grieving that has happened. And I think that's something that we'll be facing in 2021. On the slightly more positive side, it's kind of amazing to me. One other number I want to throw out there is that just here in Massachusetts, we've run over 10 million tests. And while you could certainly find a lot of fault in our testing regime, it is quite an impressive number. So all in all, you run out of words. Like, it's been cataclysmic. It's been monumental. It's been unprecedented. It's just, it's been a pandemic.
Let's start working in some listeners here too. We've got 800-423-8255. We have Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. First on the vaccine, I hope that they put on the state's dashboard the number of people who are vaccinated each day. I'm just nervous that not that I want medical people to get the vaccine, but why aren't we vaccinating the people who are getting sick and dying? Which leads me to my question. When will we know that this is working? When will we start to see deaths drop, not number of cases because it's still going to spread, but hospitalizations from the vaccine? When will I be able to go into a bar or Red Sox game? And when can I have students back in my classroom full-time without masks, without hybrids, since it hasn't been since March 12th? So when will all those things happen, in your guys' opinion?
Dave, thank you for that.
I can start on that one. Yep.
Go ahead, Carrie.
Just, we know the state has said that it will start putting out its vaccine dashboard this Thursday.
Good.
So we will at least start seeing the numbers of people vaccinated. And I think there will be categories also, but I'm not sure exactly what they would be. And I will leave our physicians to take the harder question about when we can have a normal life again.
Yeah, so there were two parts to the rest of what Dave asked, and I think we all heard kind of the frustration and urgency in Dave's voice. Part one, Dr. Boucher, I'll turn to you, which is, when's this going to be better? Let me give you that part of Dave's question.
Yeah, well, it's a really good question, and the honest answer is we don't totally know. What we expect is that the first signs that we're making progress will be when we start to see deaths slow down. But we believe that we need to get to 70 to 80% immunity by vaccine to reach what we call herd immunity, to the point where the virus will stop spreading and where we can start to let our guard down. In the meantime, we have to do all those mitigation measures that we know work, like masking and maintaining our distance.
And Dr. Pierre, so what Dave, the second part of what Dave is asking, and we will get more into this, is, you know, about prioritization in the vaccines. But I really want to use that as a springboard to back us up a little further and ask you a first part of that equity and access question, because we are doing a review of the year in the pandemic. And I remember vividly in the spring, early spring, late winter, as we began to understand the disproportionate impact that this pandemic was having on people who were already vulnerable and already marginalized. And I wonder if you can take us back to when that realization was forming and how we processed it, what it meant, and how you think we've handled it over these last months.
Yeah, this has been a year for revealing, this COVID has clarified so many different things, and one of them has been the fault lines of disparity that we work and live, practice medicine within. So back in April, I believe, we were starting to see there was a lot of advocacy for disaggregating the data regarding race, ethnicity, and COVID-related infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. And we started seeing simultaneously in the cities that were beginning to show this information, this data, in addition to the CDC, that, as many public health experts could have told you, people from Black and Brown communities were disproportionately at risk and dying from this disease. There was obviously more information and focus on this through the summer and the spring and the time of outcry and outpouring of people marching on the streets in response to the George Floyd murder, and tying those intersections of marginalization in society to marginalizations in medicine. And we've unfortunately continued to see those disparities to this time. So clearly a vaccination strategy that is going to be effective is going to be targeted towards not just prioritizing those who have higher risks of infection because of where they work, where they live, their underlying medical conditions. Many of those things place Black and Brown communities at risk, but also communicating it to Black and Brown communities who have also been disproportionately targeted for the misinformation I mentioned earlier.
So before I go back to the callers, 800-423-8255 to join our callers. Carrie Goldberg, we've just heard references. You made one. Dr. Pierre made some other references to how the state has been reporting data over this year. And that has been a big part of the arc of this pandemic, is collecting, reporting, and increasing the transparency of data. How have we done?
How have we done? I don't really feel like it's my place to give the state a report card. There were definitely improvements that were made over the months. We're still missing a few pieces. For example, it's difficult to find out if you have a relative in a nursing home or another congregate care setting. It can be very difficult to find out whether there's an outbreak and exactly how many people have gotten infected. And actually, I would just add to Dave's question, if part of that was going at the issue of age being the biggest risk factor of all, the average age of the people who die of COVID in Massachusetts is 81. We do expect the vaccinations to start in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities this Monday. So in fact, there will be, in the very first wave of vaccines, there will be those people who are at the very greatest risk of dying from COVID-19. So that's kind of a first step. But otherwise on data, I think, it's a work in progress, but there is a great deal of data that the state puts out about who's getting infected, how many tests, and so on. And there are state dashboards you can look at if you're a data person.
Thanks for that, Carrie. Let's grab one more question before we go to break. 800-423-8255. We've got Mike on the line from Lynn. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I was calling. It seems like they're not really prioritizing the people in nursing homes, that they're going to have other populations. And also, we've known that old people in nursing homes are the ones who are dying, but they haven't reduced the number of deaths in nursing homes. I mean, it seems like it's still 67% across the board. And I'm also concerned too about, you have to take two doses. So if they send out a bunch of vaccine, are they waiting for that? Are they holding that vaccine for that person to get the second shot, or are they just hoping that it comes when it comes?
That's a good question. Thanks for that, Mike. And, Dr. Boucher, I do believe that people living in all ranges of congregant care actually are in phase one of the vaccine rollout. Mike is asking, are we sure that's happening? And, are we holding that second dose, or are we distributing everything in dose one and then 3 or 4 weeks later when it's time for dose two, do we have to hope we have more inventory in?
Yeah, so great questions. And I can just confirm that people who live in congregate settings and long-term care facilities like nursing homes are in group 1A along with frontline healthcare workers. So they are at the top of the priority list. And as it was mentioned earlier, they're going to start being vaccinated here in the next few days here in Massachusetts. So that's good news. In terms of the supply, I believe that the plan, the whole manufacturing plan, I know the details more on the Pfizer side, was that they are releasing the doses in a staged way. So they have guaranteed that the second dose will come. So we are using the doses that we have with the understanding that the second doses will follow. I haven't heard the same level of detail yet about the Moderna shipment plans, but I know that's the plan for Pfizer.
WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg, Dr. Helen Boucher, who is Chief of Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, Infectious Disease Physician and the Associate Hospital Epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center. We're continuing to take your calls, both your lingering coronavirus and vaccine questions and your reflections on the year in the pandemic that has been 2020. So that number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Doctors Pierre and Boucher and Carrie Goldberg, if you don't mind, the phones are just lighting up. I'm going to jump right in with a call. We've got Stephanie on the line from Franklin. Stephanie, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just curious as to what level of protection the vaccine will afford people at home that cannot get the vaccine. I have a seven-month-old son with a history of ITP. He's been high risk this whole time since he was born in June, and I'll be getting the vaccine as soon as I can, as will my husband. So I'm hoping to find out if that'll help a little bit for him at home.
So Dr. Cassandra Pierre, it's like the echo effect of the vaccine. If one person in a household is vaccinated, how does that affect or help the other members of the household?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's the same question my husband has because I'm a healthcare worker and his baby is vaccinated. So I think what we know so far is that these vaccines have great efficacy for the individual who's taking them. So currently 95% efficacy in terms of protecting symptoms. We don't know what, if anything, what any effect they have on asymptomatic infection or transmission of infection. So that is information we are still awaiting, information that is yet to be gathered but will. Until that time, we recommend, as Dr. Boucher mentioned, people continue to wear masks, continue to physically distance. We know that if the healthcare workers are getting vaccinated in this first phase, that reduces their risk of bringing infection home with them from the hospitals or healthcare settings or the world. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we cannot get asymptomatic infection. And so we need to continue to practice our infection prevention strategies until we can ensure that at least, you know, in this case, the adults in the household can be vaccinated. And it's going to be a little while before the world returns to normal. And that means we need to continue to protect each other, even if our individual risk drops because we ourselves have been vaccinated.
Okay, thank you for that. I want to pick up Becca, who's on the line in Needham. Becca, hang on just a second. I just want to note that we have at least one other caller with the same question as Becca, so hopefully we can answer for a couple of people here. Becca, go ahead.
Hi. I am a healthcare worker, and I received my first dose of the vaccine on Friday. I am so grateful. It was earlier than I expected. My question is, we know that it might protect you against getting infected with the virus, but when and how can we be sure whether it actually prevents you from spreading the virus as if you were an asymptomatic carrier?
Good question. Dr. Boucher, can I turn to you on that one?
Absolutely. And so as Dr. Pierre mentioned, the way these vaccines were studied is in studies looking at preventing disease, sickness with COVID-19. We're still waiting the data to talk about actual infection and transmission of infection. It is being studied and we'll have a little information, but it's going to be several months before we have that data. So in the meantime, we have to act as if we could, those of us who are lucky enough to be vaccinated still could spread the virus. So we need to mask up, maintain our distance, wash our hands, avoid crowds, and stay home when we're sick. unless and until we learn differently, and likely until 70 to 80% of us have been successfully vaccinated.
So, Carrie Goldberg, I want to turn to you again for a minute, because we're not only answering listeners' questions in the moment, but we are reviewing this year in the pandemic, and you've done a number of these listener call-ins with us over the months, and there have been so many other outlets by which we are now seeing people able to ask healthcare providers urgent and immediate questions about how to behave, what their options are, et cetera. Have you, as a healthcare reporter, seen something substantially different in the dialogue between private individuals and the public health and healthcare communities this year than you've seen before in your reporting?
Oh, what an interesting question. What I have felt most of all is that healthcare reporters are basically just translators and amplifiers of what the public health officials who really know what they're talking about tell people. And it has often felt to me like there was a gap between what people needed to know and the messaging that was going out. And I don't want to cast any blame. I think a big piece of it was that one of the great takeaways here is that public health has been just incredibly underfunded for a very long time. And I think that departments of public health and even the CDC didn't always have the human power to be able to do as much communicating as they needed to do. And what we've seen is a lot of amazing physicians like Dr. Boucher and Dr. Pierre stepping up and stepping out when it is not their natural job to have to come on shows like this, and they're doing it anyway. And I just want to express my appreciation, because God knows I don't know the answers to a lot of the things people are asking.
Hear, hear, Carrie. It really has been remarkable the way healthcare professionals like you, Dr. Pierre and Dr. Boucher, have really engaged with the public. Has that, Dr. Pierre, been a really rewarding part of this for you, an uncomfortable part? How have you felt about that?
It has been a little awkward. I'm used to talking to my patients face-to-face, and not only do I now have to use telecommunication to have our visits, but they say, I heard you talking about masks on this show, and I liked what you had to say. So it has been rewarding in that way, absolutely. And I've also tried to use it as a way to talk about vaccines, because I can't see everyone at once. But it is a little uncomfortable. We are used to dealing with in the world of the hospital and the world of patients, but this has given us an opportunity to talk about public health messaging on a larger scale, which is always helpful when there seems to be a vacuum of information and guidance coming from other sectors that we traditionally look to for leadership.
So, Dr. Boucher, let's fill a little more of that vacuum. I'm going to paraphrase questions from callers Frank and Judith. Frank is 83 and not in congregate care and wants to know where he fits in the vaccine priority list. And Judith is 77 and has heard that Moderna's vaccine may be less optimal for older adults than the Pfizer vaccine. So let's go in reverse order. Any truth to the difference between the two available vaccines for older adults? And where do healthy older adults who are not living in congregate care fit into the vaccine distribution strategy?
Yeah, so great question. So the first one is, we don't have any evidence that either vaccine is better or worse for older people. They're both effective in older people and people at risk, and that's the good news. I think it's we have to be careful when we look at numbers, and there's so many numbers from these studies, not to get carried away in what we call a subgroup analysis, that wasn't really the question asked. My take on the data is that they're both effective in older people, so that's good. The second part is, where do people over the age of 75 in this case fit? And it's interesting. They probably fit in either phase 1B or phase 2, and it depends on a couple of things. One is whether or not there are other risk factors, and the other is whether the state of Massachusetts decides to change their phasing based on the CDC's recommendations from this past Sunday. So there's still a little bit of what we call a moving target here. I think the good news is both are relatively soon, and it's very much recognized that age is a risk factor, and we want to get to people in that older age group as soon as we can.
All right, I'm going to turn us to looking ahead now. So we're going to say goodbye to the remaining callers we weren't able to get to today. Thank you for calling in. We will continue to do these opportunities for you to call and get your questions answered. So do continue to listen. We will do this for you again. I want to look ahead, and Carrie Goldberg, I'll come to you first. In your reporting and the conversations you're having, I know how annoying it is to be talking about potentially another pandemic when we're still in this one. But we do try to be learning people and a learning organization. So are we learning lessons from this pandemic that may better prepare us for another that could come down the line?
Well, I certainly hope so, yes. And I think one of my biggest predictions for 2021 is that as this pandemic hopefully fades, we are going to see sort of a massive, actually a literal postmortem as we look back at all the things that we did wrong and figure out how we can do things better. And it will be such a big analysis that it will really dwarf what we did after 9/11. Like, clearly we have fallen down as a country and actually globally. And I really look forward to seeing all of the conclusions that are drawn and the changes that are made to make sure this never happens again.
And Dr. Cassandra Pierre, what is something that we will do better in healthcare writ large as a result of having found our way through this pandemic?
I believe that we are going to be taking a better look at health disparities, whether it be a pandemic or chronic medical diseases. I think this pandemic has already spurred many institutions to look inward and evaluate their own health outcomes based on demographic characteristics, including race, gender, and other factors as well. We know we have many vulnerable populations who have disparate health outcomes, so that's one thing. And one other thing, if I can just mention it, is trust. We know that we have not done a great job of ensuring the trust of the public, especially those populations who have been marginalized. And therefore, we cannot marshal any trust when it comes to making predictions, when it comes to making recommendations regarding things such as the vaccine, which we know are in best people's interest. So we are going to have to move forward into ensuring people's trust, remedying grievances from years past, and ensuring that people know, our patients know, that we care for them.
And Dr. Helen Boucher, last word, 30 seconds or so to you. What's bringing you hope as we prepare to enter 2021?
Well, Tiziana, I am hopeful that all of us will find it inside of ourselves to do the hard work we need to do to get us through these next 8 to 12 weeks, to give the gift of having a small holiday with just our immediate family with whom we usually live, wearing a mask, maintaining distance, avoiding crowds, not going to work or school when we're sick, so that we can not overwhelm the healthcare system and provide the time that's needed to get more people vaccinated so we can get to that light, which is coming. And I think we as healthcare people can promise that we'll continue to speak clearly, consistently, and truthfully as often as is helpful.
All right, that is Dr. Helen Boucher of Tufts Medical Center, Dr. Cassandra Pierre of the Boston Medical Center, and WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Thanks to all three of you for joining me today.
Welcome. Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Thanks. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.